This is Steve Turner. I'm the author of A Hard Day's Right, The Stories Behind Every Beatles Song, and also The Gospel According to the Beatles.
Steve, when were you born?
1949.
So what was your personal experience with Sgt. Pepper, your first listen? What do you recall?
I think the first that I heard of Sgt. Pepper was there was a disc jockey in Britain called John Peel, and I remember him playing some tracks. I think it was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was the first thing I heard on the radio. It wouldn't have been too long before the actual release, but I think that's the first thing I heard, and it was... Strawberry Fields had come out before, and there'd been Rain as B-side of Paperback Writer, so we were a little bit used to the Beatles experimenting a bit with their sound, but Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was very different to anything we'd heard before, and there'd been an awful lot of anticipation about the Sgt. Pepper album. I guess been a certain amount of anticipation about Revolver, but I think that when after Revolver came out, you know, the expectations for Sgt. Pepper, what they would do next, were incredibly high.
Well, in light of the fact that they were taking so long, wasn't there quite a bit, particularly in the British press, wondering if they had run out of ideas?
I don't remember people wondering whether the Beatles had run out of ideas when they were recording Sgt. Pepper, but I do remember coverage about them, sort of the comings and goings at the studio, and so they weren't really saying very much, but I remember George turning up with some sort of Indian-style coat and John turning up with an Afghan coat, and it was and the moustaches started to grow, and you know, John's hair was shorter because he'd been in that film, and it was more the comings and goings, just what they were wearing and the neckerchiefs and things like that, and they're really keeping quite quiet about what was actually happening in the studio. But it was unprecedented at the time for people to take that long making a recording. I mean, we're quite used to it now that somebody will spend 6 months or a year recording an album. I mean, it's routine now. But at that time, just a few years before, the Beatles would have knocked out an album in a day or two. That was the way albums were done at that time. But this was unprecedented to spend months and months and months perfecting a sound.
How would you describe the pop music landscape that this album was landing in? I mean, what was on the radio? What was the scene like? How would you take a crack at that?
I can't remember exactly what was playing on the radio at the time that Sgt. Pepper came out. I mean, I'd have to look back at the charts, but I know soul music was very popular in Britain, and there had been some sort of experimentation, like the Yardbirds. I think they'd done 10 years. What was it called? 10 years.
Happenings. 10 years.
Oh yeah, Happenings. 10 years. Time ago, which there was this kind of the bending of the sound and slightly. Precedence of the psychedelic sound going on. So that was in the air from about, I guess, late 65 on. There was that kind of thing happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me play to your strength then, and let's recall a bit of the stories here. Which of the Beatles led the way on Sgt. Pepper, and what was intended with the record?
Well, surprisingly, it was Paul that really shaped the album more than anyone, although people tend to think because it was slightly more freakish than anything they'd done before that it must be John. But I think John had been taking quite a lot of LSD at that time and was maybe not as active as he would normally be. And he was a bit lazy anyway. He tended to like spending time in bed. In fact, there are quite a few references to sleeping in John's songs, not on this album, but generally. But Paul was very active, and he liked doing projects. And he'd had this idea, I think, after being in France on a holiday and putting on a disguise and realizing that he could kind of move about as an ordinary person if he put on a moustache and changed his hairstyle or whatever, and he could be relatively anonymous, and they hadn't experienced that for quite a while. And then he had this idea of, well, what if we pretended to be other people and did a whole album like that? So he developed this idea of Sgt. Pepper being a band through which the Beatles could produce this album. So, you know, in a sense, they were distanced from the project. It was Sgt. Pepper's album. It wasn't their album. So that was the kind of framework that the whole thing was set up with. There was a time apparently when they were going to call the album Music No, they were going to call it Doll's House, but there was already an album by the group Family called Music from a Doll's House, so they abandoned that idea. I think people wrongly think it's a concept album in the sense that they imagine that the songs sort of run together, that there's some sort of underlying theme, but the songs were not written to any theme. I mean, there was a story out at one time that the album was planned to be all about Liverpool, and that Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields were the first fruits of that. But I don't think that's true.
You wrote interestingly, I think, about a kind of duality on this record, that it's partially a reflection of the youth culture at the time, and then it's partially sort of just typical British life. Could you explain and elaborate on that a bit?
Well, there is quite a strong element of sort of Englishness on it. I mean, from the Sgt. Pepper and the Lonely Hearts Club Band, for a start. I mean, the name is kind of psychedelic, West Coast American, like Jefferson Airplane or Big Brother and the Holding Company. It was that type of name. That's what Paul was going for. But it's also an Edwardian band in England. There's that kind of feel of like a band playing on a summer lawn in England, and some of the songs have that kind of music hall feel to them, especially like when I'm 64 is very much the sort of song that Paul's father would have played when he was playing in darts bands in Liverpool in the 1920s. And then you've got John's For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, which is based on a Victorian poster, so you've got again a kind of reference to something very, very English and very Victorian as well.
I think as we go track by track now, just and briefly, as I mentioned, you could sort of elevate what you think is most intriguing about the shaping of these particular stories or particular songs. Let's jump into the second track, as you've sort of explained where the theme comes from, with a little help from my friends. What can you tell us about the genesis of the song that Ringo sings?
All I can remember about With a Little Help from My Friends is that Hunter Davis wrote about it in his book The Beatles, which was the first authorized biography of the Beatles. And there were a couple of songs where he was actually around as they started writing them. And that made a big impression on me at the time, because you didn't really know where these songs came from. And in fact, people didn't really think where did they come from, and they weren't asked those sort of questions in press conferences. But he was around when they actually started some of these songs, and they'd had this idea With a Little Help from My Friends, and then they started just sort of tossing lines around at Paul's home one afternoon. You know, what do you see when you turn out the light? And then John was like, I don't know, but it's mine. And it was done in a fairly casual way. And they always wrote one song with Ringo in mind, you know, with his kind of vocal range in mind, and that was the one for this album.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds has an interesting story, and of course intriguing interpretations as well have dogged it for so many years. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, that originated with a little drawing stroke painting that his John's son Julian had done at his nursery school. He had a friend at nursery school called Lucy O'Donnell, and apparently he'd done this sort of picture of her, basically, with some stars around her head. And he took it home, and John said, well, what's that? And he said, it's Lucy. And then he said, it's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And John was just inspired by that line and thought, well, you know, that's a line you can build a song around. Then as he built the song up, it became much influenced by Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland, which was a favourite book of John's, and it took on that kind of fantasy element, with a little bit of the Goons thrown in, because there are plasticine porters with looking glass ties. Spike Milligan from the Goons told me that one of those things, I can't remember if it was the porters or the ties, was something that was in a Goon show script, according to him. It was that sort of surrealism was very common to the Goons, and John was a big fan of the Goons.
Which was a British...
It also has...
Steve, could you say The Goons being a British comedy TV series?
Yeah, The Goons being a radio comedy team featuring Spike Milligan, Harry Secombe, Michael Bentine, and Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers being the best known in America. And the radio series, I think, probably started about 1952 or 1953, and it was, you know, very close to the end of the last war, but it was very anarchic for its time, and a kind of a precedent for the Monty Python type of humor in the 60s.
Right. Thank you. I interrupted you there, though.
Okay. And but there obviously is this kind of psychedelic feel to the song. I mean, not only to the imagery, but to the way it was recorded. Although John always denied that the Lucy in the Sky and the Diamonds were spelling out LSD. I talked to Derek Taylor, who was the Beatles press officer for a number of years, about this, and he said he believed John when he said that he hadn't had that in mind when he wrote the song. Because he said, you know, every time that he did slip in a drug reference, he was very proud of it and would boast about it. And he certainly didn't shirk from talking about what drugs he took. So there'd be no reason why he would play that down. But I can't imagine him having written it if he hadn't have gone through those experiences.
Right. I was interested in your book about where you feel or had read that Getting Better came from.
Yeah, Getting Better came from something that Jimmy Nicol used to say. And Jimmy Nicol was a drummer, sort of a session drummer in London. And when Ringo had, I believe it was appendicitis or tonsillitis, and had to go in a hospital, and the Beatles were off touring in Australia, Jimmy Nicol had to step in. I think he's the only person to sort of play the role of a Beatle in the Beatles during the Beatles' career. And when they were backstage, during, you know, after these concerts, they'd say, "How's it going, Jimmy?" And he'd say, "Oh, it's getting better all the time." And Hunter Davis again recounts how this song came to be written. And I think Paul was walking around Primrose Hill in North London with his dog, and this phrase came into his head, you know, it's getting better all the time. And he just sort of spun the story out of that phrase.
And it's an example, again, of Lennon and McCartney working together to sort of counterpunch each other or counterbalance each other.
Well, I think so, because even though it sounds like a Paul song, you know, the lines about, you know, I used to get mad at my school, that sounds very John. I didn't read of Paul sort of feeling that way about school, but John certainly did, and, you know, filling me up with your rules. It's a jaunty kind of song, but there is a kind of countercultural subtext to the whole thing, I think, really.
Yeah. Fixing a Hole also apparently actually has a precedent in what, Paul's farmhouse architecture, isn't it?
Well, Alistair Taylor, who used to work for the Beatles, he said that when Paul bought his house up on Kintyre, which was a farmhouse, a very remote farmhouse without any sort of modern amenities, and Alice used to have to go up there and sort of handle the painting and things like that. He reckoned that the song was written around that time, and you know, there are those references to cracks in the door, and you know. But Paul also said that it was, I think it was about like not being on the road and being able to just go to sit and be quiet, and you know, it stops my mind from wandering. I think they were finding opportunities to just sit and think and relax and read and go and see films, which they hadn't been able to do for a long time. They'd really been gigging since about 1958. I mean, there'd been gaps, but they'd really been on the go for almost a decade. And this was a time to sort of kick back and think and wander and wonder.
And yet some people dragged this song into a drug reference context as well, didn't they?
Well, some people thought, because it said fixing a hole, that it was about fixing. It was about taking a drug fix. It was about heroin. But, I mean, Paul dismissed that pretty abruptly. And I've never heard anybody suggest seriously that that's what it was about.
She's Leaving Home. Really gorgeous McCartney tune, largely, I suppose.
Yes, She's Leaving Home is very much a Paul song, and he'd seen this this news item in a British newspaper about this girl who had run away from home, and her parents or her father was quoted as saying, you know, I don't know why she did it, we gave her everything. I actually tracked this girl down, and her name was Melanie Coe, and she came from a fairly wealthy Jewish home in North London, and her parents had given her everything materially, but there was something sort of missing from her life, and she was like a prototype hippie sort of leaving home. I think that song really keyed into that feeling in 67 of, it was a time when a lot of kids were leaving home, and San Francisco was a great magnet for these kids going out and wanting to find themselves, wanting to find a new way of life. So even though it's a very sweet song and very much a Paul song, it also, again, has that kind of countercultural subtext, really fitted in with the spirit of the times.
You mentioned briefly the Benefit of Mr. Kite song, or more accurately, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, coming from a circus poster. Could you tell us more detail about how literally it did happen that way?
Yeah, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite was John going to an antique shop in Sevenoaks in Kent. They were at a park called Knoll Park, filming the what we'd call a video today, but they weren't called videos in those days, but they were doing this little film sequence to promote Strawberry Fields Forever, which had the piano strings hanging down from the tree and things like that. And popped into this antique shop and saw this poster. It was a Victorian poster for a benefit show at a circus in, I think it was in Rochdale in North England. And John just sort of liked it, bought it, and it went up on his one of his, I don't know if it was his study or his studio wall. It was framed and hung on the wall. And he was looking up at this one day and thought all the words and the kind of antiquated phrases in the song would make a great song. And he more or less lifted it. I mean, he changed a few things just to fit the rhyme, but they were more or less lifted from this poster. And there really was a Mr. Kite and the Hendersons. And Pablo Fankes was actually a guy of African origin who ran fairs in the 19th century in Britain. And I actually found a photograph of him. So it was great to find these people actually existed.
Mm-hmm. We've talked earlier about George Harrison finding the sitar during the Help sessions and then trying it a little bit on Rubber Soul and a little bit more on Revolver. But here on Sgt. Pepper, it's a whole other step, isn't it? Tell us that story.
Yeah, Within You, Without You was George's most, I guess his most sort of religious song up to that point. And it kicks off, you know, what was the second side on the vinyl version of Sgt. Pepper. And it grew out of a sort of a late night discussion that he was having around at someone's flat. They were talking about the sort of Eastern religious ideas, and that's where that was the genesis of that song. And there are actually some phrases from the Bible in it as well about you know, losing your soul, gaining the world and losing your soul.
And am I correct that no other Beatles are playing on this? This was all session musicians?
I believe that's true. George had met Ravi Shankar in, I think, 65 and had become very close to him and had been introduced to other Indian musicians, and he joined the Asian Music Circle in London. So he was, I mean, in fact, at the end of 66, he went out to India and studied under Ravi Shankar. He was really keen to develop that side of his music and wanted to learn the sitar, but realized quite early on that it was, you know, to master that instrument, it wasn't like playing a guitar. You really need to give your whole life to it, and he could never do that.
Now, When I'm 64 evidently was written by Paul as a very young man, but came back out here for Pepper.
Yeah. When I'm 64 was written by Paul as the sort of song he knew his father would like, and he was very young when he wrote it. I think he was maybe 16 or 17. And the only time they used to play it was, I think, at the Cavern when, you know, if the something went wrong with the equipment and there was a pause, they would Paul would sort of set the piano and play it. But it was a song that was kind of resurrected and put on this album. And it kind of fits in because I think one of the things with this whole sort of LSD period was the sort of shifts in time. I mean, you could be an American Indian, or you could be a Victorian soldier. You know, there were these kind of cultural and time shifts. And so it was quite appropriate that you go from India on track one on side to the sort of Edwardian or you know, immediately after the First World War sort of dance band type of music.
Just as an aside, you know, in the midst of the generation gap that, as you noted, was pretty well illustrated in She's Leaving Home, you know, I found it always interesting that, you know, here's 20-something Paul McCartney basically, you know, fast-forwarding his life a bit, and it felt kind of empathetic to me, reaching across the generations a bit. You know, what... I'm just tossing that out because it always struck me that way.
I think, despite the sort of friction between the generations, I mean, Paul was very close to... I mean, his mother had died when he was 14, but he was very close to his father. And I think his father was coming up to 64, or was 64, and I think that probably affected why he called it When I'm 64. And in Britain at that time, 65 was the age for retirement, so that might have had something to do with it as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Any known source for Vera, Chuck and Dave, or is it just...
No, I think I asked Paul's brother about that. Vera and Chuck and Dave are just names that came in his head. I've never found any relation that was called Vera, Chuck and Dave. I think Paul... often, I mean, Paul's quite good at coming up with lines and phrases that sound good, but might not mean anything particular. But he knows exactly the right sound. And Vera, Chuck and Dave, I mean, they do run together beautifully. And I think he was good at that, and that's all it is.
Right. Lovely, Rita. Interesting in the way you describe it, because it, I suppose, was intended to be... more sharply critical or something. Can you talk about how the tones flip-flopped on that?
Well, yeah, there was... when I was writing my book, A Hard Day's Right, there'd been a story around. There was a woman who thought she was Rita, the Meter maid, because actually her name was Meter, M-E-T-A, and she'd given Paul a parking ticket at some point outside Abbey Road. And she was convinced that the song was about her, but Paul always denied that it was about anybody in particular. But he'd we didn't have well, we call them parking wardens, and we didn't have them until, I guess, the late 60s. So around this time, they were very much a novelty in this country. But some American friend of his had said that they called them meter maids in the States, and he just liked the alliteration of it, and he was playing with it. And I think he was up at his father's house up in Heswall, just in Cheshire, and he was just playing around on the piano and making up this song about a meter maid. And it's a little sort of subversive story in some ways. I mean, it's got some reference to having tea, and there's something about the mother and daughter situation. So.
Yeah, and I think your book, and what I was referring to is, I think, you know, most people loathe the meter maid because they're writing tickets and nobody wants a ticket, but he thought it would be fun to flip it around and fall for the meter maid.
Yeah, Paul said something like he liked this idea. You've got this very military-looking woman, this woman in a uniform, and yet you were going to seduce her, and he thought that was his little subversive bit on that.
I've always been fond of Good Morning, Good Morning. I find it like a really driving, energetic track. What are some of the stories behind this one?
Well, Good Morning, Good Morning, it's another one of one of John's lazy songs, if you like. If you can't write a song about anything, you just write a song about not being able to write a song about anything. He did like lounging around, and that's one of his lounging around songs. There was apparently a television advert for Kellogg's Cornflakes that had this jingle on that said "Good morning, good morning," and that's what gave him the kickoff line for that. And it's just about doing nothing at home, and his wife going out and going to take the kid to school, and there's nothing doing, everything is closed, it's like a ruin. That was really John's life at the time, because Paul was living in St. John's Wood, close to the Abbey Road studios, and he was having the time of his life, you know, going out with Jane Asher, being invited to art gallery openings, and meeting up with Antonioni and watching movies, and John although John had been the art student, he was really stuck in Weybridge with his wife, who he wasn't getting on too well with, and sort of running dry of inspiration, really. And Paul was really commanding the Sgt. Pepper album. And I think there was the need to come up with material. And if John couldn't come up with material, he'd just write about laying in bed or doing nothing.
Yeah, and toward the end of this song, you know, whether it's a fantasy of his, he actually does get out into the scene, and there's a sort of spicy lines about, you know, flirting and getting in gear.
That's right. There's a line in it about, it says it's time for tea and Meet the Wife. Meet the Wife was a TV program at the time. Yes, that's all I know about that song.
Right. So the reprise comes back around. Anything valuable to say about, you know, the second coming of Sgt. Pepper on this album?
No. The only interesting thing about the reprise is it's because of that, because it starts out with the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band song, and then it ends with this reprise. I mean, it's that bookending of the album that gives people the impression that it's some sort of concept album. I guess without that, people would be less likely to think that it was a concept album.
And then a Day in the Life is certainly important to mention in terms of the story.
A Day in the Life was one of these examples of Paul songs and John songs being stuck together. I don't think they were looking at it as an artistic breakthrough. I think they were just thinking, like, well, Paul's got a song and he's not finished it. I've got a song and I've not finished it. Let's put them together. So, you know, it starts off with the more sort of languid John talking about reading a newspaper. And that was a reference to a friend of theirs who'd been killed in a car crash. They'd seen it in the newspaper. A guy called Tara Brown, who was a friend. He was more of a friend of Paul's than John's, actually. And he was an heir to the Guinness family fortune. And he died in a car crash in Earl's Court in London. And then, you know, there's references to the English army just won the war. I mean, John had just done this film, How I Won the War. And then it comes to, woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. That very jaunty bit is, you're back to Paul. And so they really just kind of splice these songs together.
And before we sign off, Steve, let's say a word about another word. You mentioned it earlier, but the single, because there are stories worth noting about Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, obviously.
Mm-hmm. John wrote Strawberry Fields Forever when he was in Spain filming. He sat on the beach, and there are some sort of rough acoustic versions of it around. You can hear him kind of developing this song. And it was quite a departure for him, and it was one of his favourite songs. He felt it was had a lot of personal meaning for him. And Paul and John used to sort of compete with each other. And I guess when Paul heard Strawberry Fields, and Paul would have known about Strawberry Fields, obviously, because it was a Salvation Army home in Liverpool, not far from John's house. Then he did his Liverpool song, which was Penny Lane. Penny Lane's not very far from Strawberry Fields. And they're very different songs. I mean, John's is much more like an interior journey. Paul's is a very sort of like, almost like magical realism comes to Liverpool.
Very descriptive of what you might find on Penny Lane, actually. Or
well, it's funny that the kind of incidental things in the song you might see, you know, like the banker and the rain and the hairdresser, but it's given this kind of magical gloss. If you listen to the song, you think it must be talking about a summer's day, because he talks about the blue suburban skies. But if you look at the lyric, it's actually about a rainy day. But everything's kind of enchanted in the song. It's not a very attractive part of Liverpool, Penny Lane, but when you listen to that song, you think it's absolutely glorious. You know, it's like a picture postcard. But I think Paul had that ability to sort of just sort of put this sheen on something that's very ordinary and transform it. So he has a lot of very ordinary things in there, like fire engines and bankers and umbrellas and nurses, but he makes it seem very magical.
And you write that street signs around Penny Lane have to be strategically placed now, is that right?
Well, the only ones that I know now that I've ever seen are kind of really high off the ground and they're screwed down, you know, the Penny Lane signs, because obviously tourists will be, or people that want to sell such things will be cutting them down and selling them off.